Welcome to episode 65 of Meenal's World. Thank you all for joining me again this week. I've just realized that I've released 15 episodes straight through since relaunch, and I have to say, I feel very, very proud of that. A lot of work does go into getting these guests on and mainly syncing calendars because I'm working around Radhika. So thank you all for keeping me going and always sharing your feedback. It really does mean a lot. This week, I want to share a story with you, which I'm certain will bring you to tears, but also give you a lot to think about and have a lot more perspective on what we've all been through in the last couple of years. Rupinder Kaur is an entrepreneur, mother, and her journey in building her empire has been one that's been full of so many ups and downs, and this dates back to years ago. And what you see on social media is everything that she's built now, but I really wanted to share her story because this idea to create this business to help other women started off a long time ago. And then through that, we discussed the journey as a mother. And then, of course, that's when all the tears came in. So you'll find out more about Rupinder's journey in this episode. Welcome to the show, Rupinder. It's so lovely to actually just have an hour with you with no distraction, no baby, and nobody coming in between us.
I love that. Thank you for having me on. I'm such a big fan of your show, Meenal. It's such an honor.
Oh, thank you, Rupinder. You're definitely one of the first people and probably maybe the only person who's left a review on iTunes. So
oh my God,
I appreciate the support.
Go and leave Meenal a review and a rating. Please, please, please do it on, and particularly on iTunes. It makes all the difference because what it then does is gives exposure of that podcast to others. So if you enjoy it, and I know you enjoy it, please, please, please do that. She's probably too humble and modest to ask you to do it. So I'm saying it instead.
Thanks, Rupinder. I guess I don't need to do an intro to this podcast. I'll just jump straight into you. Well, Rupinder, I have a lot to talk about with you today, but I wanted to start off with your, I'm going to call it your empire, Asian Women's Meet Business. That's what I'm going to call
it. Love it.
You built an empire and I'm there for it. I'm always there supporting you and I'm always cheering you on because everything that you do has helped me and has impacted me as well. But I know that it sort of escalated quite a lot in the last couple of years during the pandemic. So what actually happened during the pandemic that made you think, okay, this is what I'm going to put my full focus and energy into?
Yeah, so did you hear the sigh? It's funny when people say that about it being an empire. And I can see that from looking outwards in, it may look like that. And I do a lot of things. But this has been a really long slog. And I just want to make that really clear that there is no such thing as an overnight success. Asian Women Mean Business was initially set up nearly 8 years ago and came about because I had left the corporate world and was freelancing as a HR consultant and a coach and a mentor. And the first thing people tell you to do when you've set up as a freelancer and you've set up your own business is to go out and network. Go out to networking events, go out and meet people, get the word out. And the idea is that that's how you drum up clients and business. And can I just say, 8 years ago, the climate and everything was so different. We weren't using social media the way that we're using it now. Obviously, it was pre-pandemic. The world was just so different. So I started going to all these networking events and always left feeling like there was something that just didn't hit the mark for me. I never felt welcomed. I never felt seen. I never felt validated. And as the saying so often goes, that sometimes you need to create what you want to be a part of. So having gone to all these types of networking events, I was like, right, I need to create something that is for me and for others like me. And at that time, I then met a business partner. We decided to launch Asian Women Mean Business together. And for 18 months, Meenal, it was a slog. We were doing networking events in London, in Birmingham. We were everywhere. We were really trying to figure out how we could grow and sustain this business. And after 18 months, you know, we fell out of love with each other and we fell out of love with AWMB. And she actually then managed to secure a full-time gig back in the corporate sector. And I thought that's the right thing for you to do. I couldn't quite let go of AWMB, but I knew I needed a break. So I stepped away from it. And what was supposed to be like a six-month break turned out to be 3 years or something. It was ridiculous. And so then in that time, I went through my own challenges, my own growth, went through infertility, went through some health concerns, went back into my HR career and then decided that actually there was still something with me that was unfinished with AWMB. So just before the pandemic, in very early 2019, I decided to resurrect it. So I had still had the hosting platform. I still had all of that. I was still paying the fee for the domain. So I went back to our tech guys and said, remember me, let's resurrect this. We're going to do it again. And this time I'm going to do it by myself with all the knowledge, all the learning, everything I've learned over the last few years. And I'm going to do what suits me. And what suits me is I'm going to work part-time as a head of HR, and I'm going to resurrect AWMB, and it's going to be my side hustle. We're going to do coaching and mentoring through workshops. We'll have an online platform that showcases and promotes women talent in our community and is inspiring and uplifting. And that's it. Like, this to me is the life. I'm doing my corporate career, which I love, and I'm doing something out on the side. In 2019, AWMB just exploded. So every time I put out a workshop, it sold out within days. Every time I put out a coaching program, it sold out. And there was such a thirst for wanting more that ultimately I had to make a decision. And the decision I had to make was that I have three buckets. I have my children. I have a very young family. My son is only 4 now. So he was 1.5 when this was all really happening. And my daughter is 10 now. So I have my children, I have my HR career, and I have AWMB. And something has to give because it's too much. And in that moment, it was, well, obviously, I've got my children for life. I can't give them up. So it's that balance.
Hopefully they don't hear that, Rupinder.
Well, no, they know this. My daughter knows this. I've told her. I was like, this is what I had to do. So it was like, right, do I pack in the AWMB stuff or really scale it back and just concentrate on the HR job? Do I leave my HR career and just go all in with AWMB? What do I do? And I decided at the tail end of 2019, it was literally on New Year's Eve 2019, I submitted in my resignation and I decided to bet on me. And my rationale was, I'm putting out workshops, they're selling out. I'm putting out coaching programs, they're selling out. I'm being asked to speak at events. I'm being asked to do stuff. So why wouldn't I bet on myself at this moment in time, knowing actually, if it doesn't work out, just as it hadn't really worked out previously, I'll just go back to HR. I'll go back to what I have my degree in. I'll go back to my corporate career. So that was in December, like I said, New Year's Eve 2019. Handed in my notice and had to work out my notice period, which was 2 months. So this takes us up to February 2020, the very last week of Feb, handed in my notice, handed over to my replacement. I was like, right, Rupinder, the world is your oyster. You're going to smash it with Asian Women in Business. You have all these speaking gigs lined up. You have coaching and mentoring lined up. You've got workshops lined up. This is it. And at that time, we were all hearing whispers of this pandemic this outbreak that was happening in China. And all of us thought, it's not going to happen here. It's not going to come here. And, you know, fast forward to sort of March and April of that year, it was here and we were in lockdown. So it was April 2020, we were in lockdown. All of my work was cancelled. All of the corporate, you know, coaching and mentoring, all of my clients cancelled. All my speaking gig was cancelled. And, you know, if we just take ourselves back to how fearful we were then, we didn't know what to expect. We went into lockdown. I remember reading something on LinkedIn. Someone had put up a post and it said, coaching and mentoring and training is a luxury item now. No one is going to touch it. No one wants it. We're in survival mode. And when you're a coach and a mentor, that's the last thing you want to read when your livelihood depends on it. But I took some time out. I took 10 days out and I had this 10 days of just WTF, like, what am I going to do? And I really berated myself for leaving my secure head of HR role, this regular paycheck. I didn't qualify for furlough. I couldn't go back to them because they had replaced me. And I just remember kicking myself and berating myself, thinking, why did you do this? And also what kicks in is all of your previous mistakes and your previous fears. So everything that had happened sort of the 8 years before had kicked in as well. And so I took 10 days out and just went into contemplation and meditation. And I just realized that everything I talked about with others, I needed to practice on myself. So I listened to what others were telling me. And what they were telling me was, Rupinda, we're scared. We don't know what we're doing. How are we going to make it out of this? What are you doing to make it out of this? How can we help each other? How can we support each other? How can I work with you when you only have a workshop or you only have a coaching program, which is a high-end coaching program and they can't invest in? And so at that time, I thought, I need to offer something that is going to be feasible for my community, but also pays my bills, which also places a value in what I do. And so with off the back of that, we launched our membership program, our Inspire Club, which I've got to be honest, I really didn't know what I was doing. And I just thought, right, I'm going to put something together which is offering coaching and mentoring and community support. It has to be online because that's the world we're living in now. And together, we are not only going to make it out of this pandemic, we're going to make it out of the pandemic stronger. We're going to thrive through this process because I know I have access to the tools and the resources to be able to do that for not only me and for you. And so we launched Inspire Club in May 2020, 5th of May 2020. So 2 years ago, we opened the doors and we had 135 founding members. And it was at that point, I just thought, I can do this. If there's 135 women in a pandemic, believe in me and believe in this, we can make it work. And that's what we did. And for me, it was just really important, Meenal, because everything we do with AWMB is, you know, it needs to be more than just a pithy quote or an inspirational message on social media, because that's great. But where do you go after that? Where do you go to learn how to be more resilient, to build these muscles? And you're not going to get it just from an inspirational quote. And so that's what we do with Inspire Club. That's what I do with AWMB. But really, it was that point. And from the back of that, you know, we now have our membership. I can't wait. We're going to start our workshops again. I have our coaching program. We have our paid book club. We have the podcast and we launched the directory last year as well, which is for South Asian female-owned businesses. It's been incredible. It really has been absolutely incredible, all during a pandemic.
Wow. You've put that so eloquently and you've put the timeline together so nicely in my head. And I can visualize the steps that you were going through to make those changes and to make those decisions. Because I think a lot of women have been in the same situation in their life, Rupinder, especially after having kids. Your life changes, you know, you have a baby that you need to feed and your priorities change and the life before having a child doesn't really work anymore. Things change. I wanted to go back to those 10 days that you took out, Rupinder. What were those 10 days like? Because I'm sure you were going through a pros list and a cons list to decide what to do. Obviously, finances was one of them, as you'd mentioned. I want to go a bit deeper and ask you, what else were you looking at apart from the money involved in the next few years to raise your family? What else were you thinking about?
So I remember it really vividly. I went into fear mode. And actually, that's something that took me by surprise because it's one thing that I thought I had worked through with my faith, my religion, my beliefs, and this sense of, you know, what can I control? What's outside of my control? Accepting in divine will. So actually really shook me how scared I was and how much I went into fear state. And I do this thing where that, because my background is I have a degree in psychology. I have a master's in HR. For nearly two decades now, I've been working in psychology and coaching and mentoring in HR. So I know how the human mind works. And even in that moment, I remember thinking to myself, right, Rupinder, you are in fight or flight. This is what's happening to your body. This is what's happening to your senses. This is what's happening to your mindset. And this is how we need to now overcome this and come out of it. So literally, I think for those first few days, it was just a speaking to myself and rationalizing how my body was feeling. Because I literally felt like the rug had been pulled out from under me. And I'm sure we all felt like that. But for me, what was just really discombobulating is that I use my intuition and my inner knowing as my compass to inform the decisions that I make. And it was really clear to me, Meenal, on the 31st of December 2019, the messages I was getting was, you need to leave your job, you need to go all in with AWMB, this is it. But that was so clear to me. And it was with that belief, I handed in my notice, I worked through that notice period, I left that security, that regular paycheck. And then to be hit with this, the suddenness of having work cancelled, of having all of this just literally go away overnight. And it wasn't just me, by the way. My husband had his contract cancelled. So literally both of us we didn't have a job. We didn't have money. Yes, we're so fortunate. We had savings. We've got assets, which we called upon. But there was nothing coming up in terms of, well, what does this mean for us? What does it mean in terms of getting us securing a job? And so that was really, really frightening. And it was really interesting to me. And even now, when I take myself back in that place of the turmoil, the uncertainty, the fear, and literally working through the process of, right, what does this actually mean? And I remember saying to my husband, look, everything we have is just physical stuff. If we have to give up our house, if we have to give up our cars, if we have to pull out our children from their schools, for us, the worst case scenario is we go and move in with your mum, or we move in with my parents. Like, how fortunate are we that we have family and parents that will take us in, that will make sure we're okay? And actually, if that's the worst case scenario, we are okay. And it was that rationalization to myself that we're going to be okay. And I think once you understand that, so once I understood that, and I remember I had a conversation with both my parents and my mother-in-law. My father-in-law passed away 11 years ago, but I spoke to, you know, both sets of our parents. And I remember my mother-in-law saying to me, Rupinder, this is nothing. You know, she said, I remember the days of the Thatcher government, of conservatives, of there being 18% interest rates, of houses being being repossessed, of jobs going. And she remember her saying to me, if we've made it out of that, we can make it out of this. And then I remember talking to my mum, and there's something, isn't there, about the relationships that we have with our parents, that it doesn't matter how old you are, you still go into that inner child. And I remember speaking to my mum, and I remember I started crying because I was so in so much fear of what does this mean, and what does it mean for our livelihoods, and what does it mean for our life. And my mum was so incredible because she said to me, she said, none of this matters. And she said, even if we had to sell everything that we have in India, and they've got land and a property, she said, even if I have to sell everything I've got in India, even if we have to bring all of that over to make sure our kids are okay, we will do that. So why are you worried? And that was it. I mean, even now I get choked up when I remember that, because And that was it, me now. The switch just came on. I just thought, Rupinder, you've got nothing to lose. Because anything you think you're going to lose is fine, we'll deal with it. But you're okay. You've got your health. You've got your husband. They've got their health. Your parents are sound. You've got their support. So actually, when you've got nothing to lose, you just effing go for it. And so with that contemplation, I remember thinking, right, what would I do? What would I do then? What would I create? What can I put out there at this moment that I feel is of service to others, that is of value to me, and that it literally, you know, the Inspire Club idea came to me. And I remember reading once, J.K. Rowling shares about how the idea of Harry Potter just came to her, and it was fully formed And all she had to do was channel it, and it flowed. And that's how I felt it was for me in that moment. Once I had overcome the fear, once I'd had those conversations, once I had allowed myself to be vulnerable, once I had made peace and acceptance, genuine acceptance and surrendered to, if my house goes, it goes. If my cars go, they go. If everything goes, it's fine. From that place, what can now I create? It allowed me to be fearless, and it allowed me to create something that I'm not sure would have come into fruition in any other way.
Rupinder, I remember speaking to Otto English. He's a writer who wrote the book Fake History. I spoke to him a couple of months ago, and he made a very good point. He said that the COVID, the era of the pandemic, for us is like our World War II. You know, our parents went through migration, they went through all of that. And this, the pandemic kind of was, I mean, it's not obviously the same, it's different in so many ways, but that was our crisis moment. And that's what it was for us. So using our parents' knowledge to be able to overcome these obstacles is so valuable. And you're right, we're so lucky that we have them. You know, you're lucky that you have your parents, I'm lucky I have mine, but a lot of people didn't have that. And I could only really appreciate that, Rupinder, because I was working in the hospital, right? So I saw people from all walks of life coming in, you know, people who are immunocompromised, people who are on jobs allowance and seekers allowance, they don't have that money. And I think that for me, you know, really helped me have that perspective to be grateful, because as you're right, actually, the things that we think we're going to lose are actually not losses. And that's such an important like shift to have when you're making these big decisions. And Rupinder, you'd mentioned that you'd taken like a 3-year break between when you'd first set up AWMB to when you started to think about it again. In those 3 years, you went through quite a few challenges, and you've been quite vocal about your own issues with fertility. And even I think there was a post that you'd written about how you'd lost a lot of weight because you were going through so much stress. And, you know, your family were concerned about what that meant. Was all of this happening within that 3-year period?
Yes. Yeah. It was such, again, it was such a real baptism of fire, I think, in terms of, we were going through secondary infertility, unexplained infertility. So we were trying to have our second child. It just wasn't happening. At the same time, my mussy G, so my mum's younger sister was diagnosed with breast cancer. She was diagnosed she was 48 years old, and then she died at 50. And so that was not only a huge loss, but navigating a terminal illness with someone you love so much is brutal. Whilst you're going through your own struggles, it is so difficult. And then underlying all of that, I was going through an episode of just chronic sickness, chronic illness, always having stomach issues, digestive issues, and the pain. And I can say this to you, Minal, because you're a doctor, obviously. The pain was so terrible. I remember I was... you know, over-the-counter painkillers just wouldn't touch it. And I remember I went to see my GP, and she was so lovely, but I was sobbing. I was in so much pain. And she said, Rupinder, the only thing I can prescribe is Tamadrol, but you need to be, you know, it's opiate-based. It's a really hardcore drug. And I remember begging her for it and saying, I'm in so much pain. And so I remember taking that for the pain, and that was awful because I was having hallucinations. I remember lying in bed and thinking I could hear the washing machine and the dryer going. And I remember shouting out at my husband, like, switch it off. And he'd come rushing upstairs, like, switch what off? And there's nothing on. There's just you and me. There's at school. It was just horrendous. And then, I was having some diagnostic tests done, for bowel cancer and stomach cancer, because that was where the symptoms were heading. So, you know, to be in this scenario of dealing with secondary infertility, dealing with an aunt who is going through cancer, going through your own physical, mental, emotional pain, then being told, actually, your symptoms look like this. It was such a difficult time. I think, and that's why when I say that what happened in the pandemic, I was shocked at how much that had brought back the fear in me, because I thought, oh, you know, I've already gone through some really difficult times. But thankfully for me, the diagnosis wasn't cancer. It actually was burnout and was stress, which came as a result of so many things, Meenal, but underlying it all was my inability to say no, was my people-pleasing tendencies, and just everything else that I was going through at the time as well. So yeah, it was a really, really difficult time. And so that's why initially when I had said, I just want to take a break from AWMB, 6 months, I'll be back. It turned into so much longer.
Mm. What was that period like, Rupinder, when you're someone who's so driven to be successful in your career, someone who's so passionate about achieving your goals, not just for yourself. Isn't it all just about you? And I know that it's for the goodness, you know, for the public and for women around us. Did you ever feel like taking a step back was letting anybody down?
Yeah, I did. Actually, I felt such a sense of failure. I felt like my body had failed me, like physically, not being able to get pregnant, being sick. I felt my spirit was broken, you know, dealing with my aunt's terminal illness and then her, and knowing that it was terminal. So you're literally, you're waiting for a person that you love to die. And that's so you're grieving while they're alive. And that was really, really difficult. And I'm the one in my family, and I'm sure many can relate to this, particularly if you're the eldest. So I'm the eldest daughter. I'm the eldest in my generation. So I have all my cousins are younger than me. I'm the one that everyone looks up to in terms of, oh, she's got her stuff together. She knows what she's doing. Let's ask her. I'm the fixer in our family, the extended family. I'm the one that everyone comes to. And then not being able to do that, not being able to fulfill that, it felt like such a failure. It really, really did. And it was something that took me a long time to get my head around, in terms of that none of us are invincible, how important it is to look after ourselves and, you know, our physical well-being, our mental, emotional, our spiritual well-being. And how important it is to role model that. And that's why I'm so passionate now. So, you know, one of the things that most people will know me for is that I say no to 90% of the things that are asked of me, because I know what happened when I was saying yes to everything. Yes, I'll have a coffee break. Yes, you can pick my brains. Yes, I'll meet you in Midlands. Yes, I'll drive up there. Yes, I'll drive up to Leeds. Yes, I'll come back in one day. And what eventually happened was that it led to my burnout and led to me being really, really sick. And that meant that I was of no service to myself, my family, my children, and ultimately the community that I want to serve as well. So it was a big wake-up call.
How was your husband feeling during this time? Because I remember when I had Radhika, and obviously I only realized the impact being a mother had on me a year later, because I was so sleep deprived, Rupinder, I just couldn't emotionally process anything. And now that, you know, Nishant and I are in a much better place mentally, emotionally, we can talk about it and actually say she was actually quite tough on both of us, you know? But I didn't realize it at that time. Obviously, I was going through my own stuff, and I think we were trying to deal with our own emotions individually, which wasn't healthy at all. You know, we deal with it in our rooms at night and then come, you know, say good morning to each other the next day as if nothing was wrong. And we were, you know, raising the perfect family. What was it like for your husband? Because I know it must have been very difficult for him to see you go through such a difficult time.
Yeah, he did find it really challenging. And I also didn't help the situation in that I wouldn't let him in into my world of the pain that I was feeling. And because I felt like that was weakness. And even now when I'm saying it, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, everything is perfect. But how I felt at the time was, I'm okay, I've got it sorted, I'm the superwoman. And it felt like I couldn't show him or anyone else my vulnerability or any weaknesses. So he found it really, really difficult, and probably very similar to what you've just shared, in that I wasn't honest with him. And how can I be honest with him or anyone else when I wasn't honest with myself, when I didn't have the self-awareness or the ability to understand how I was feeling and processing all of this stuff? And I just think, you know, the conversations around mental well-being and health have moved on in the last 5 years, which I think is so important. My hope is that by some of the conversations that we're having, and you have, Mina, on your platform, is that we can lift some of the stigma around this now, so that it is okay to say, actually, I'm not okay, I'm not dealing with this very well, and I need to take a break, or this is what I need to do for myself. But yeah, he did find it really, really difficult, because I wouldn't let him in. I wouldn't share with him what I was really going through.
It's really interesting, because Nishant is a GP, and he's, you know, he speaks to new mothers all the time. So he knew what I was going through. But because I wasn't vocalizing it, because I wasn't being open about it, he couldn't put his finger on it. And I think we were quite lucky in the sense that as doctors, we were sort of acutely aware of what was going on. But I know a lot of women go through this, a lot of husbands go through this, and they just don't even know this exists as a problem. So we were very fortunate in that sense. How old was they at this time? So your eldest is your daughter. And yeah. How old was she at this time?
So she was, how old was there? So she would have been four. Yeah, she was four.
How did it impact your role as a mother?
Yeah, that's a really good question. How did it impact my role as a mother? That's a really good question, and something probably I've not really thought about.
Well, think about it now. Yeah, yeah. This is your time.
In that, I think we're so fortunate in that we've got incredible family support around us, with our parents and our extended family. So there's a lot of love there, and there's a lot of, you know, that saying, and I really believe in this saying, and I lean on it, and I know it's a cliche, but it's a cliche because it's true. It does take a village to raise a child. We're not designed to bring up these mini humans by ourselves. We are, you know, as human beings, we move in packs, we move in tribes. It's really important that we call upon that support. And so one of the things that I had started to do was ask for that help. So ask my mother-in-law, ask my mum, ask my cousins. And because of that, that gave me some time and space, I think, to work through the health stuff, the emotional and mental process that I needed to go through as well. So I remember being present in the sense that there was a lot going on. I mean, there was so much going on in that time, but still being present for her. And here's the thing, Daya's 10 now, and she's very vocal, like really vocal about, so she'll say to me things like, if now at the moment, you know, as the world has opened up, I've been going to a lot more events, I've been doing a lot more stuff. And so she said to me the other day, I feel like maybe you're doing too many things, and you're not spending time with us. And I love that, though, because that's what you have to look forward to as well, by the way, that when our children start to fully articulate their needs. But she also always says to me, and here's the thing, since I've had Daya, for the last 10 years, I have been in the incredible fortunate position that I've not worked full time. I've only ever worked part time. I've either that's been freelancing or even with the head of HR stuff, it's only ever been part time. And so I have been fully present for when she has needed me. So that's been incredible. But I do think also, you know, we've got to be mindful about how we're raising our children and what we want them to see. And do I want my daughter to look at me as a superwoman mum who does everything, who doesn't fall down, who doesn't have off days, who isn't a human being? No, I don't want that. I don't want that for her, because we're setting unrealistic expectations for our daughters and for the next generation on what it takes to be a mum. And so I'd rather her see me in my wholeness of, yes, I have flaws. Yes, I have days when I am too busy. Yes, I have days where I'm not feeling great. And see the wholeness of that, which I think is much more important than I speak to parents sometimes and they say, oh, no, we don't show our children that side. We keep that. And I'm just thinking, I think that's doing a disservice to our children. I think they need to be able to see what it takes to be a parent and for us to be honest about that.
So even the other day, we were out with Radhika in the park and I just felt exhausted. And then Nishant just looked at me. He's like, Meenal, what's wrong with, like, why aren't you smiling? It's a sunny day. Like, Radhika staring at you, like, what's wrong with mommy? I just had like a blank face, just literally staring into the clouds because I was just so exhausted. And I said to Nishant, I said, look, I understand that Radhika is at that age now. She's almost two and everything around her is just happy, Rupinder. Like, that's all she knows. Happiness and sometimes a bit of sadness if she doesn't get what she wants. But that's the world she knows. So when she looks at me and I'm not smiling, she's just like, what's wrong? What's going on? So I'm also trying to understand that as a mother, I also have to, you know, be a role model and say, look, Radhika, mommy's not having a good day today. And this is how I'm feeling. Because ultimately that opens up the conversation for her as well in the future, for her to come to me and say, mommy, I'm having a difficult day. And it's very difficult to get to that stage because not only do your children see you as role models and super moms, but you also want to be that super mom to them as well. And it's very difficult to find that balance. You have Sahib now who's four.
Yes.
And you mentioned that you were going through your obstacles with your fertility. So how did Sahib come to this world?
How did he come to this world? As a whirlwind. Honestly, it's one of those miracles of life that, and I love these stories. I hear these stories with other people and I love them. So we were struggling for 2 years and I have a condition. I have polycystic ovaries and I always knew that was there. However, we conceived there very, very quickly. And that probably gave me a false sense of security in terms of when do we start having our second child? Of course, that's going to happen as quickly as the first child. And so very deliberately, we waited three and a half years before we even started to consider whether having another child. And it was at that point, it just didn't happen. It didn't happen as quickly as it had happened with Daya. So that knocks you back a little bit. And then you just think, okay, let's just keep going. Let's see what's going to happen. And, you know, very quickly, the weeks turn into months and the months turn into years. And so we had all the tests done and we were exploring lots of different options. And throughout this whole time, so this 2 years of infertility is, you know, when I was saying that my mussy was going through her terminal cancer diagnosis. I was going through illness, burnout, fatigue, my potential stomach cancer issues. And so this was a really, really difficult time. And then and what happened was that we were exploring various options and, you know, talking to my parents and my mother-in-law about the struggles that we were going through and some of the options and what to do. We then discovered that my mussy had taken a turn for the worse and her cancer literally, you know, she had weeks. And so we parked our IVF plans and I decided that what I really wanted to do was spend those final weeks and months with her. And I have no regrets about that. That was absolutely the right thing to do. Eventually got the phone call to say, the doctors have given her hours. And so I went to spend that time with my family and we went through the whole process as we go through, as South Asians, we go, and as Sikhs, we go through a certain mourning and grieving process, a funeral process. So that probably took about 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks. She had always wanted her ashes to be taken to India. So we had a date and my cousins and my Masterji said, can you come with us? I was like, absolutely, I'm going to come with you. And so what happened was that initially we had parked our IVF plans for a few weeks and those few weeks turned out to be about 3.5 months in the end. And so I went to India with my family. I was there for 10 days. We did the ashes. We did everything that we had to do. And as I left Delhi, was on the plane, I remember this so vividly. So this is like March 2017. I remember thinking, gosh, I feel really sick. I feel nausea. I just felt nausea. And remember thinking, right, it's obviously the stress of the last few days, and you know, you've been helping. I was helping my cousins navigate their grief. They'd lost their mum. They, you know, we were there in India to do the ceremony with her ashes. Came back to London. Came back to the UK, and it was probably another 2 days had gone by. And Harinder said to me, he was like, "Oh, you've been like saying you're not feeling great. I think you need to do a pregnancy test." And I was like, and I at that point, and if anyone has struggled with fertility, you will know, you don't want to do pregnancy tests anymore, because every time they're negative. So the thought of doing them in itself is not a pleasant experience. And I was like, no, you know, I don't want to do it. We know that's not the case. We're going to start IVF soon. And he was like, no, I really think you should. And actually, he was so adamant that we had no pregnancy tests in the house. He was like, right, I'm going to just get hot footed to the chemist. Went to the chemist, came back. He's like, I really think you need to do it. Did it. And bearing in mind, we'd been trying for two and a half years at that point, because of those additional few months where we delayed our IVF. And I put it on the side thinking, it's going to be negative. It's always negative. And I just, even now, I just remember looking at it and my hands shaking because it was positive and I was pregnant. So after that turmoil of 2 years of exploring all of these options of delaying our IVF treatment so I could be with my mussy and my family, I fell pregnant, like completely naturally. And it happened. So that was how Sahib was conceived and how it happened. And I actually had a really, really difficult pregnancy. It was the grief of losing my mussy coupled with, I think, the fear of finally being pregnant was just this melting pot of not great emotions. It felt very heavy. I felt very sad. I remember everyone saying to me, "Don't, you know, you shouldn't be grieving so much. You shouldn't feel so sad. It'll affect the baby." But that's how grief works, and that's how it is. And you can't tell your grief to go away for the day because you're pregnant. And so I had various complications with my pregnancy, and I actually had preeclampsia. So when I eventually went into labor, that was hugely traumatic. And I had preeclampsia. So preeclampsia obviously is when your blood pressure increases, when your body starts to attack itself. And the only way to stop it is by stopping the pregnancy, so getting the baby out. So we had this hugely traumatic labor. So when I say Sahib was this whirlwind, you know, he made us wait for two and a half years to get pregnant. Having him was just full of so many emotions. That pregnancy was full of so many emotions. And then eventually the labor was full, just so traumatic. And then I had him. I always knew me now, actually, throughout the pregnancy, I always had this underlying thing. There's going to be something with this baby. And I didn't know if it was my fear and my sadness and my grief that was driving that, or whether it was just, again, this inner knowing and this intuition. And so when I eventually had him, and it was like, oh, you've had a boy, and it's like, yeah, great, our family's complete, you know, finally got pregnant, finally had this baby, I just still remember feeling there's something that's going to come. And I just, you know, when you're just waiting for the other foot, you know, the shoe to fall off. And it was probably a few hours later that Harinder, you know, everything's fine, here's your baby. And Harinder, you know, had Sahib, so he's unrobing him. He's like, this is my baby. And he looks at his hand and he looks at me and he says, "Rupinder, he's got 3 fingers missing." And I blacked out. I don't even know where this has come from, but yeah, it was just, I think at that point was just the culmination of the past 2.5-3 years and how difficult it was. And that took me into a very dark place. And I just want to be really clear on this, not because my son was born with 3 fingers missing. It was because of everything we had gone through to get to that point, and then to have him, and then to be hit with that as well. So that was really, really tough. And the first 6 months, so not only was the pregnant, not only getting pregnant was difficult, the pregnancy was difficult. Having him the first 6 months were really, really challenging.
Sorry, Rupinder, I'm really sorry to hear you went through that. And I can't imagine how difficult it must have been. I always see it from the other side as a doctor. Even when I had Radhika, because I've seen everything, unfortunately, thousands of things were going through my mind during my pregnancy as well. I was also trying to be very grateful at the same time that I was blessed and I, you know, was able to have a baby. It's very difficult to juggle these emotions of gratitude, but sadness as well. Did you ever find out why he had some missing fingers? Or?
No, we didn't. So we know he has a diagnosis of Poland syndrome, which is a genetic, which has, you know, other people have it. And we were really fortunate, actually, because the hospital I was at, they within 24 hours, we had a diagnosis. They knew what it was. They had, there's an organization called REACH, a charity called REACH, which is for children and families with upper limb differences. They had given us the leaflet. I rang them. I remember ringing them. I was sobbing on the phone to them. They were brilliant. So we were really lucky in that, and that we were able to get the medical diagnosis very, very quickly, and we were able to get support very, very quickly. But it was just a shock. I think it was, and I remember when I rang the charity REACH, and I said to them, and they have family liaison people, and I remember saying to them, I'm just so shocked, and you know, because it hadn't been picked up on any of the scans, it wasn't something that I had been expecting. None of us expect this stuff to happen to us, and you know, I've got friends who have children with various conditions, and I don't, you know, I understand how painful it is and the shock of it. But something she said to me, which I thought was so incredible, and subsequently, I work as a family liaison officer with that charity. So when anyone has a child with a condition like this, they, if they want to speak to a parent who's a little bit further on in the journey, I speak to them because I know what it feels like. I know what that moment feels like. But what she had said to me in that moment was, look, Rupinder, if this had been picked up in the scan, in the 20-week scan, you would have had 20 weeks to get to your head around it, to start to accept it. And she said, so what I'm going to say to you is, why don't you give yourself at least 20 weeks now to get your head around it, to accept it, to get yourself into a place where you can see the silver lining, that you can feel more optimistic and positive about it. And the great thing about that charity is that they have children and adults that are doing incredible things, because that was my fear. Like, how is this going to restrict him? How is it going to limit him? What does it mean for him? And because I don't have this in my family or my immediate circle, it was the fear of the unknown. And what this charity were able to do was show me and remove that fear, because they were able to show me children and adults that were thriving, you know, that were Paralympians, that were playing musical instruments, that were incredible. And so that's what I did. I really took her words on and I said, right, you're going to give yourself. And actually, what I realized was, by her saying that to me, she gave me permission. And that's what I realized, that so often we as women are looking for is permission from someone else to say, why don't you give yourself the time to do this? And that's what she did for me. And so I remember like speaking to Harinder and my parents and my mother-in-law and saying, oh, I spoke to the charity and this is what they said. So actually, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give myself 20 weeks to be there for him, and but get myself in a good enough place. And they were really accepting of that, and they were really accommodating. And so that was really, really important to me, that I had that time to myself. And here's the thing, you know what you were saying earlier about when you and Radhika were in the park and you were tired, and how you wanted her to see you. And even though this, in amongst all of this, one thing I knew was, how we share the news, so how I share the news to my parents, my mother-in-law, to our extended family, to Daya, about Sahib's hand, is first of all, it's going to be their experience of it and is how they will handle it. So if I am crying and like I have been now, but if I'm crying, if I'm depressed, if I'm in a state of fear and panic and anxiety, that's how they're going to potentially match my energy. And I was really worried about that with Daya, because I thought, I don't want that to be her introduction to her brother and his hand. And so I actually did something really controversial, which is we didn't tell Daya about, so she was six. We didn't tell Daya about Sahib's hand for 6 to 8 weeks. I think it might have been 8 weeks. So he was a baby. He was wrapped up in his, you know, the blanket. He had the mitts over his hands. She didn't actually see his hands. But because I was so mindful that how I tell her is going to shape her experience of it, and I can't tell her when I'm crying and not in a good place, because I do not want that to be her experience of her mum telling her, we waited. And so that was incredible, because Harinder was on board. He was like, yeah, completely agree. That's the right thing to do. My parents and my mother-in-law, they were like, yeah, that's fine. And so we waited. We waited until I felt fit enough, strong enough, mentally resilient enough to show Daya and have that conversation. And the way I did it with her then was because in 8 weeks, I had managed to get myself into a place of, you know, having the support, having spoken to the charity, having seen the possibilities of what other children were doing, having my husband's support, having our family support, I was in a much better place. So I could say to Daya with optimism and positivity, I actually said to her, Daya, I've got something to tell you. There's something so special about your brother that you've probably not even noticed yet. And she was like, really? What is that? So I said, look, come over here. And so then I showed her his hand and I said, he's not got three fingers. Like, isn't that incredible? And her face was like, her jaw dropped and she was in wonder. And she just looked at me and she went, oh my God, that's so cool. And I knew then, like, I knew we had done the right thing, because if I had told her at any time sooner, that would not have been her experience of it. And that shaped how she then went back to school and told her friends and told her teachers and how they were coming to me and talking about it. And so there is something about, we do get to shape our children's experience, and we can be very, very mindful of that. And I was, again, I was just really mindful of the energy that I wanted in my space. And so I remember saying to my parents and my mother-in-law, I don't want anyone coming to me and giving me pity or sympathy, or I don't want any of the hi, why did this happen? Why did that happen? I don't want any of that. We're going to process this in how we think is the right way. And the only people that can come into our energy and into our space are those people that are going to meet us with the same level of positivity and hope and optimism and faith. Because I'm already in fear. I don't need anyone else's fear added onto this. And again, they were incredible. Like, my parents and my mother-in-law were like, yeah, you're right. That's fine. Who do you want to see? And actually, there were only five people I wanted to see, and everyone else. So every time anyone said, oh, can we come and see you? Can we come and see the baby? We said, no, it doesn't work for us. We're taking time as a family. And then eventually we went back to them and told them the reasons why. But in that time, we kept it, like, I literally kept my circle so tight and so mindful of who I wanted in my space.
Wow. How's Sahib doing now?
He's great. He's such a... Yeah. And again, like, all the fears I had about like crawling and dexterity and how's he going to use his hand and how's that going to be? All of those very, very quickly went. And then you're always left with the fear of other people, and especially other children's reaction to him and response to him, and also how he is going to feel about himself. But what I said, I remember saying, having this conversation with my mother-in-law then and subsequently too, which is, our goal as a family and as his parents is to fill his self-esteem and self-worth and self-confidence and his love and bucket so much that even when the world pokes holes in it, which inevitably it will, it pokes holes in all of us who are, have all our digits and everything is whole, right? That he knows who he is and he knows that he has this collective group of family, of people that love him and unconditionally. And that's what we focus on. And so we're so lucky that we have that. And he has his cousins who love him. And he's great. He's what he's brought into our lives, Meenal, is, I mean, just another level of compassion and clarity and purpose. As all children and as all human beings do, we're all gifts and blessings to each other. All of those fears that I had in the early days, they've just melted away.
I think that's incredible, Rupinder, to be able to tackle that with such clarity emotionally as well, considering you were going through so much. It's a truly an incredible story. And I hope a lot of our listeners can gain some inspiration from this and some, you know, learn something from this as well, to always find that silver lining, but it doesn't have to be immediately. You can take your time. Rupinder, there's so much more I want to talk to you about, honestly, but I know you have to go. I know we're a bit rushed today, but the beauty about this podcast is I love having people back. So we can always do this again at some point in the future when your empire becomes, you know, when it dominates the world, I'll bring you back on. But Rupinder, just before we finish off, I wanted to ask you, if anybody's listening and wants to be a part of your work or wants to get involved, what's the best way to do that?
Thank you. So we do, Asian Women Mean Business, we have got lots of free resources. We have a really robust, comprehensive website where you can read blogs and get inspiration. We've got ebooks, we've got the podcast. There's lots of stuff out there for free that is all about supporting South Asian women who are daring to dream bigger. And our intention is always just to plant those seeds of what if. And if they can do it, and I can do it. So there's all of that. And then if you are interested in any of our services, we have obviously our membership, which is Inspire Club. It's a personal and professional development club for South Asian women. There's the workshops that I do, retreats, and but everything is on the website. There's something for everyone, whether you want to pay for it or whether you want it for free. I've tried to make it as accessible as I can.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time today, Rupinder. I can't wait to see what else you got in store over the coming years.
Thanks, Meenal. It's been a joy.
Thank you. And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in to another episode of Meenal's World. And thank you, Rupinder. And to all the guests who join me every week, your time is so valuable and your stories are so incredibly inspiring. I've left all the links for Rupinder's socials in the show notes below. I've also left a link for her Inspire Club, and I know that this is coming out on Friday morning and the doors to her Inspire Club close on Friday night. So you do have a few hours, and if that's something that might work for you, please do look into it. If you are on iTunes, please do subscribe and rate the podcast. It helps us reach out to more people. And if you are on social media, you can follow me at Dr. Meenal Viz. You can also subscribe to my newsletter, which you can find on my website at meenalviz.com. I hope you have a lovely weekend and a lovely week ahead, and I can't wait to see you again next Friday.